welcome to the Saving Castles podcast, the sanctuary for castle devotees and medieval history enthusiasts. Prepare to embark on a thrilling voyage through time as we unveil enthralling history and legend. From ancient folklore to cutting-edge restoration, we've got it all covered. So grab your headphones and let's dive right in.
In the intricate tapestry of medieval Europe, few figures loom as large or as enigmatic as Isabella of France. Whispered about in court halls and sung about in ballads, the She-Wolf of France, a name that speaks of power, defiance, and a fierceness that would both reshape and redefine the course of English history. The air was thick with anticipation as the year 1295 dawned upon the world. Castles dotted the landscape like silent sentinels, their stone walls holding within them the secrets of generations. Within one such majestic structure in Paris, Isabella was born, a princess heralded by fate itself. Her lineage was illustrious. She was the child of King Philip IV of France and Joan of Navarre. In her veins flowed the legacy of the House of Capta, a lineage that had its roots deep within the annals of time. Young Isabella, with raven-black hair and piercing eyes, grew up surrounded by luxury and opulence. Yet this luxury was not just in material, but also in knowledge. For within the courtly walls of the French palace, the air was thick with political machinations, discussions of war and peace, and the age-old dance of alliances and betrayals. From her earliest days, Isabella was both a spectator and a player in this grand theatre of royal diplomacy. While other children might have been ensnared by fairy tales and lullabies, Isabella's lullabies were the soft murmurs of courtiers plotting, and her fairy tales were the real stories of kings and queens who had risen and fallen in the game of power. These were the stories that shaped her, molded her, preparing her for a destiny that would see her become one of the most formidable queens in history. Yet, for all the grooming and preparation, nothing could truly ready her for the storm that awaited across the English Channel. England, with its rugged coastline, misty moors, and towering castles, was a land of mystery and magic, a place where legends were born, where knights sought the Holy Grail, and where dragons lurked in the imaginations of its people. But beyond the legends, the real England was a cauldron of political intrigue, much like France, yet distinctly unique in its challenges and opportunities. It was to this land that young Isabella would eventually set sail, not as a conqueror, but as a bridge of peace, in a time when the drumbeats of war echoed ominously across the lands. For the English and the French, always at odds, always at each other's throats, sought a momentary truce, a pause, a chance to regroup and rethink. And it was believed that a marriage, a union of two souls from these warring nations, might just be the key. Isabella, even in her youth, was acutely aware of the weight of the crown and the expectations that came with her title. She was not just a princess. She was a pawn, a chess piece in the grand game of monarchies. Her marriage, her life, her very future, all were tied to the intricate web of alliances, treaties, and the ever-shifting sands of diplomacy. As the sun set on one of her final days in France, one can imagine young Isabella standing atop a castle tower looking out towards the horizon, the golden hues of the setting sun casting long shadows as the winds of fate whispered tales of what was to come, tales of love, of betrayal, of war, and of a legacy that would stand the test of time. For those who called her the She-Wolf did so with a mixture of fear, respect, and perhaps a tinge of envy. For in her heart, Isabella held the power to change the world, to reshape kingdoms, and to write her own destiny in the annals of history. In this episode, dear listeners, we embark on a journey, a voyage through time across stormy seas, into the heart of castles and into the soul of a queen who would come to be known as the She-Wolf of France. Brace yourselves, for the tale has only just begun. in the heart of medieval Paris, within the towering walls of the Palais de la Cité, the story of Isabella took its formative steps. The palace, a sprawling testament to Capetian grandeur, was not just stone and mortar. It was a living, breathing entity, echoing with the whispers of ages past and the hopes of a prosperous future. Born in 1295, Isabella's entrance into the world was heralded with the peal of bells and the jubilation of a kingdom that celebrated the birth of yet another link in the glorious chain of the House of Capet. Her father, King Philip IV, known as Philip the Fair, wasn't just a monarch. He was a vision of kingly grandeur, a ruler whose reign was marked by his expansionist policies, reforms, and the dissolution of the Templar Order. By his side was Joan of Navarre, a queen in her own right, bearing the dual responsibility of two crowns. Amidst this power and prestige, young Isabella grew. Each day was a dance of lessons, from languages to the arts, from governance to the delicate art of courtly etiquette. Her tutors, chosen from the brightest minds in Christendom, ensured she was fluent in Latin, well-versed in scriptures, and adept in the intricate dance of diplomacy. But it wasn't all just textbooks and lessons for Isabella. The Palais de la Cité was a hub of cultural exchange, a melting pot where troubadours sang ballads of distant lands, where tales of chivalry and valour were not just stories but lived experiences. In this cauldron of knowledge and artistry, Isabella's mind was sharpened, her spirit kindled. However, the true education of a princess wasn't found merely in books or ballads. The real lessons lay in the veiled corridors of power. From behind curtains and beneath the arches, young Isabella observed the theatre of politics. She watched her father, the stern and strategic Philip, maneuver the intricacies of his realm, dealing with dissent, fostering alliances, and sometimes wielding the sword of justice with an iron grip. From her mother, she learned the balance of grace and power, understanding that a queen's strength was not just in her crown, but in her conviction. Isabella's younger years weren't devoid of play and mirth, though. The gardens of the palace were her sanctuary, where she would escape with her siblings, playing games that mimicked courtly intrigues, laughing under the Parisian sun, all the while unknowingly preparing for a destiny that awaited across the sea. At times, when the weight of her birthright felt too heavy, when the walls of the palace seemed to close in, she'd find solace in the palace's chapel. The soft glow of candles, the serene ambience, and the tales of saints and martyrs offered her a glimpse into the world beyond the tangible, a world where destiny, faith, and will intertwined in mysterious ways. As the years waned, and Isabella blossomed from a child to a young maiden, the world around her shifted too. France and England, two mighty realms, constantly found themselves on opposite sides of destiny's coin. Tensions simmered, alliances were tested, and the spectre of war lurked. In this ever-changing landscape, Isabella was not just a spectator. She was a key piece on the board, a pawn, perhaps, but one with the potential to change the course of history. So, when the whisperings of a marriage alliance began, it wasn't just the union of two souls at stake. It was the very fabric of European geopolitics. Isabella, with the wisdom beyond her years, knew this all too well. The carefree days in the gardens, the hushed lessons in palace corridors, and the serene moments in the chapel had all led to this moment. As the sun set on this chapter of her life, the horizon beckoned with promises, challenges, and a destiny intertwined with that of a kingdom across the channel. But Isabella, with the spirit of the Capetians coursing through her veins, was ready. In the twilight of the 13th century, Europe's political landscape was a kaleidoscope of shifting allegiances, each turn refracting a new pattern of power. England and France, two titans of the age, frequently found themselves locked in a tango of ambition and rivalry. But as with any dance, there were moments of harmony, fleeting pauses where peace, however brief, could be entertained. Enter Isabella, barely past the tender age of childhood, yet poised at the epicenter of one such harmonious pause. Her marriage to Edward II of England was not just a union of two souls, but a fusion of political aspirations. It was a delicate stitch in the fabric of European diplomacy, a stitch meant to mend the tears of past conflicts and prevent new ones. Edward, a monarch often viewed through the lens of historical critique for his personal choices and controversial relationships, was a figure ensnared by the weight of the English crown. Underneath the sheen of his regalia, he was a man burdened by the expectations of his lineage, the challenges posed by his barons, and the ever-present shadow of his father, the formidable Edward I, whose legacy was both an inspiration and a chain. As the news of the impending marriage echoed through the courts of Europe, it was met with a blend of hope and scepticism. Hope, for those who saw in it a chance for lasting peace, and scepticism, for those who had witnessed the ephemeral nature of such alliances before. The setting for this grand union was Boulogne, France. As the date approached, the town transformed into a tableau of medieval pageantry. The streets, draped in rich tapestries, resonated with the melodies of lutes and the poetic verses of troubadours. Nobles from both realms, dressed in their finest, converged to bear witness to an event that promised to reshape the geopolitical contours of their world. Isabella, draped in robes that shimmered like the confluence of dawn and dusk, was a vision of regal elegance. Her every step, every glance bore the mark of her upbringing, an upbringing that had groomed her for this very moment. Edward, on the other hand, stood tall and resolute, well aware of the significance of the vows he was about to take. As they exchanged their vows, the air was thick with both anticipation and the collective breath of a thousand attendees, each praying that this union would be the balm to soothe centuries, old wounds. But beyond the grandeur, beyond the vows, and beyond the political implications, at the heart of it all were two individuals, two souls thrust together by fate and diplomacy, carrying on their young shoulders the hopes and aspirations of two mighty nations. It's easy to forget amidst the historical narratives that Isabella, still in the bloom of youth, was navigating not just the complexities of international politics, but the intricate dynamics of marriage. Whispers and hushed conversations filled the corridors in the days following the wedding. Some spoke of the chemistry between the couple, some speculated on the future, while others, with a cynical tone, pondered the longevity of the peace this marriage promised. The newlyweds, meanwhile, embarked on their journey to England. As their ship sailed across the Channel, one can imagine Isabella gazing at the distant shores of her new home, a realm rife with its own challenges and mysteries, a realm where she would need to wield her influence, not just as a queen, but as a diplomat, a peacemaker, and at times a warrior. In this dance of marriage and diplomacy, Isabella and Edward were not just partners. They were the embodiment of the age-old adage that the personal is political. Their union, while forged in the crucible of diplomacy, would go on to be tested by the fires of rebellion, intrigue, and the very essence of what it means to rule. The green and rolling hills of England, with its imposing fortresses and bustling market towns, presented a panorama of power and promise. But beneath this veneer, the English court was a simmering cauldron of intrigue and ambition. Into this vortex stepped Isabella, the fresh-faced French queen, armed with dreams and burdened with the expectations of two realms. The heart of this tumult was Edward II, a man whose passions often clouded his judgment. Among his close companions was Piers Gaveston, a figure whose influence over the king was the subject of many a whispered conversation in dimly lit corridors. Gaveston, flamboyant and unapologetically ambitious, occupied a place in Edward's heart and court that many envied and despised. His rapid ascent, bolstered by royal favour, was seen by many of the old English nobility as an affront to tradition and order. Isabella, ever the diplomat, found herself navigating this intricate web. Each day was a balancing act, where she had to play the doting wife, the astute queen, and the observant foreigner. the presence of Gaveston and later Hugh Despenser the Younger, another of Edward's favoured companions, complicated this delicate dance. Their influence over Edward was palpable, and the court, like a ship in stormy waters, lurched from one crisis to another. Rumblings of discontent echoed throughout the realm. The barons, proud and powerful, chafed at Edward's perceived mismanagement and the undue influence of his favourites. Their grievances, whispered first in secret meetings and covert letters, soon took on a more vocal and at times violent tone. The ordinances of 1311, a set of rules imposed by the baronial faction, sought to curb the king's powers and limit the sway of his favourites. The political landscape was shifting, and at its centre was a king torn between personal loyalties and the duties of his crown. Amidst this storm, Isabella's position was unenviable. As the daughter of the French king, she had to ensure that the interests of her homeland were protected. As the Queen of England, she was expected to support her husband, even as his decisions and associations threatened the stability of the realm. And as a woman, she faced the myriad challenges posed by a patriarchal society where her influence was often undermined and questioned. Yet she was not one to be easily deterred. With grace and tenacity, she began to carve out a space for herself. Through patronage, diplomacy, and a keen understanding of the nuances of the English court, she started to build a network of allies and supporters. However, the challenges kept mounting. The escalating conflict with Scotland, the persistent tensions with the barons, and Edward's own erratic leadership plunged England into a period of instability. Battles were fought, not just on distant fields against external foes, but within the very walls of the English court, as factions vied for dominance. In these trying times, Isabella's relationship with Edward became strained. The gulf between them, both political and personal, widened. Isabella, ever observant, saw the winds of change. She realized that for the sake of her children, her position, and the very future of the English monarchy, she would need to make choices, some of which would alter the course of history. As the sun set on this chapter of England's tale, the stage was set for a dramatic shift. The players were in position, and the she-wolf, with her keen instincts and unwavering resolve, was ready to make her move. Amidst the shadows and intrigues of the English court, the figure of Isabella began to emerge, not as a mere silhouette, but as a beacon of assertiveness and ambition. If the earlier years of her queenship were about navigation, this period was about assertion. The quiet French princess was transforming into the formidable she-wolf of France. The heart of her discontent and subsequent rise lay in her estrangement from Edward. The king's infatuation with Hugh Despenser the Younger was more than a thorn in the side of the nobility. It was a dagger to Isabella's heart. The Despensers, with their unchecked ambition, began amassing lands and influence, often at the cost of other nobles and, crucially, at the expense of Isabella herself. Their ascent, however, was not merely a matter of courtly influence. It was a threat to the very essence of the English monarchy. Isabella, though marginalized, was not powerless. With each slight, with each betrayal, the fires of her ambition were stoked. She began to cultivate a faction of her own, drawing the disaffected and the disgruntled to her side. Her charm, intelligence, and the inherent authority of her position as queen made her an attractive ally, a beacon for those weary of Edward's misrule and the Despenser's tyranny. The political climate reached a boiling point during Isabella's diplomatic mission to France in 1325. Ostensibly in the realm, to resolve long-standing disputes between England and France, Isabella seized the opportunity to consolidate her power. Refusing to return to England as long as Despenser remained at Edward's side, she became not just a queen in exile, but a symbol of opposition to Edward's reign. In France, her path converged with Roger Mortimer, a charismatic and influential noble exiled for his rebellion against Edward. Their alliance, forged in shared ambitions and possibly deeper personal passion, became the bedrock of a formidable political and military coalition. Theirs was a partnership of equals, united in their desire to reshape the English realm. As the months passed, the duo's intent became clear. This was not mere political maneuvering. It was the prelude to an invasion, with a blend of French support, disaffected English nobles, and a promise of a better future. Isabella and Mortimer launched their campaign. The she-wolf was not just on the prowl, she was leading the hunt. The invasion, initiated in 1326, was swift and decisive. Edward's support crumbled, as did the once mighty edifice of Despenser's influence. Town after town, castle after castle, the realm welcomed Isabella, not as a conqueror, but as a liberator. By the end of the year, Edward's reign had effectively come to an end, and the Despensers met a grisly fate. Yet the heart of this narrative was not the battlefield. It was the transformation of Isabella. From a young princess used as a pawn in the games of kings, she had evolved into a queen who moved the pieces on the board. Her actions, while driven by personal grievances, were also a testament to her vision for England, a realm free from the caprices of a flawed king and the machinations of overambitious nobles. The she-wolf had risen, not out of the blue, but from the very fires that sought to consume her. Her story was a testament to resilience, ambition, and the age-old quest for power. But as with all rises, questions loomed on the horizon. What would this new beginning bring for England? And what would be the cost of this ascent? In the vast tapestry of history, certain alliances stand out, not merely for their political ramifications, but for the intricate personal passions and ambitions that shaped them. In the early 14th century, a bond formed between two figures, disparate yet aligned in purpose, Queen Isabella of England and Roger Mortimer, the exiled noble. This alliance would come to redefine the course of English history. Picture a setting far from the English shore, the French court, where Isabella found herself on a diplomatic mission. France, the land of her birth, now became the backdrop for a new chapter in her life. It was in this milieu that she encountered Mortimer, a charismatic nobleman with a grievance against King Edward and a burning ambition that matched Isabella's own. Mortimer, having previously rebelled against Edward's rule and his favouritism towards the Despensers, had been imprisoned in the Tower of London. However, with a daring escape that would become legendary, he fled to France, where he began plotting his return and retribution. In Isabella, he found not just an ally, but a partner, someone whose dissatisfaction with the English court mirrored his own. Their alliance, initially political, soon took on layers that went beyond mere strategy. The whispers of courtiers and chroniclers alike spoke of a burgeoning romance, of stolen glances and secret rendezvous. Here was the Queen of England and an exiled rebellious noble. Their union was as scandalous as it was powerful. Their shared disdain for the Despensers and Edward's mismanagement became the foundation of a partnership that sought to challenge the very heart of English royalty. The political machinations that followed were nothing short of masterful. From securing the support of the French crown to rallying disaffected English nobles, the duo meticulously crafted a blueprint for a coup. Yet, this was not just a tale of political intrigue. It was also a deeply personal journey. For Isabella, Mortimer offered a reprieve from the emotional turbulence of her marriage to Edward. In Mortimer's company, she found solace, understanding, and perhaps love. Their bond, forged in the crucible of shared ambitions, was a testament to the human capacity for connection even amidst political upheaval. The depth of their alliance became evident when they led the invasion of England. However, like many alliances forged in adversity, the true test for Isabella and Mortimer came in the aftermath of victory. With the young Edward III as the monarch, they became the de facto rulers of England. Power dynamics shifted, and the very bond that seemed unbreakable began to show strains. Mortimer's unchecked ambition and increasingly autocratic rule began to overshadow Isabella's own influence. The Queen, once the driving force behind the alliance, found herself in the shadows of her partner. The English court, once jubilant at their return, began to murmur in discontent. The seeds of dissent once sown against Edward II were now directed at the very architects of his downfall. In the realm of power, relationships are often transactional, and alliances, however deep, are susceptible to the corrosive influence of ambition. The union of Isabella and Mortimer, which began as a beacon of hope, soon became a symbol of the unpredictability of political partnerships. For every rise, there's a potential fall, and as the sun set on their combined rule, the shadows of betrayal loomed large. Amid the ceaseless dance of history, there emerge moments that are neither a whisper nor a shout, but a clarion call. Such was the invasion of England. With the tide of destiny at their backs, they would set in motion events that shook the very foundations of the English monarchy. Let's look at this more closely. Picture a coastline shrouded in mist, the somber grey of the sea reflecting the turbulent skies above. Ships, dark and foreboding, appear on the horizon, heralding not just an army, but a promise of change. At the helm stood Isabella, the she-wolf of France, her determination unyielding, her purpose clear. Beside her, Roger, Mortimer exile turned invader, his eyes filled with the fire of retribution. This was no ordinary invasion. It was a return. Isabella, the very queen of the realm she now sought to conquer, was armed not just with swords and shields, but with a sense of righteousness. She sought to reclaim England, not for herself, but for her son, the future Edward III. As their forces landed in Orwell, Suffolk, one might have expected fierce resistance. But the England they met was a nation weary. Many saw in Isabella and Mortimer not invaders, but liberators. Town after town opened their gates, not to fight, but to join this growing tidal wave of rebellion. But this journey was not without its challenges. The duo's strategic brilliance shone brightly as they navigated the complex mosaic of medieval politics. By ensuring the support of key English nobles and leveraging the grievances of the common people against Edward's regime, they masterfully turned potential foes into allies. Edward II, for his part, seemed paralyzed, unable to muster a decisive response. The dispensers, once the puppeteers of the realm, now found their strings being cut one by one. Hugh Dispenser the Younger, in particular, the king's favourite and the object of much of the realm's ire, saw his fortunes crumble as rapidly as they had risen. The climax of this invasion was not a grand battle, but a series of surrenders. London, the heart of England, opened its gates to Isabella, a clear sign that Edward's rule was truly at an end. The king, abandoned by most of his allies, fled but was soon captured, his fate sealed. The brilliance of this invasion was not just in its military tactics, but in its symbolism. It was a testament to the power of leadership, of capturing the zeitgeist of the times, and of channeling the collective discontent of a nation towards a singular purpose. Yet the true genius of Isabella's and Mortimer's strategy lay in its aftermath. With Edward deposed, the way was clear for Edward III to ascend the throne. The she-wolf had ensured not just her return to power, but had set the stage for her son's reign. It was a masterstroke, a blending of personal ambition with a maternal instinct to safeguard her progeny's legacy. However, in the corridors of time, the invasion of 1326 also serves as a somber reminder. Power, when sought and attained, carries with it the seeds of its own decay. Isabella and Mortimer, united in purpose during the invasion, would soon find that ruling a realm was far more complex than conquering it. The very foundations they laid, while strong, also contained within them the fissures that would soon challenge their alliance. In the grand theatre of history, where destinies are made and unmade, there are acts of ascension and those of descent. The deposition of Edward II heralded the dawn of a new era, but as the curtain rose on Isabella and Mortimer's regency, the English realm found itself at the precipice of another tumultuous chapter. Picture a court awash in the golden hues of victory, but beneath this facade lay the undercurrents of intrigue. With young Edward III crowned but still a boy, the real reins of power were firmly in the hands of his mother, Isabella, and her confidant Roger Mortimer. A regency was established, promising stability and renewed governance. But as the days turned to months, it became evident that this period would be anything but tranquil. Isabella, once hailed as the liberator of England, now faced the immense task of governing a realm riddled with divisions. Her love and protectiveness for her son were unquestionable. Yet the Queen's reliance on Mortimer began to raise eyebrows. Roger Mortimer, the once exiled noble, now stood as the most potent figure in the English court. His ascent was meteoric, and with it came a lust for power that seemed insatiable. The early days of their rule saw a series of decisions that would define their legacy. The fate of the captured Edward II was a paramount concern. Rumours and speculations abounded. Some whispered of his quiet retirement to a monastery, while others spoke in hushed tones of darker fates. The mysterious circumstances of his reported death in Berkeley Castle in 1327 only deepened the enigma. Under their governance, the Despensers met grim fates, with Hugh Despenser, the younger suffering a particularly grisly end. This was a clear message to all. Opposition to the regency would not be tolerated. The court, once a place of festivity, became an arena of suspicion. Nobles who had once supported the Queen and Mortimer now began to view their rule with growing unease. The very allies who had been instrumental in their rise to power started to feel sidelined, their voices drowned amidst the regency's ever-tightening grip. For the people of England, the promise of a brighter era soon dimmed. High taxes and the continual political machinations weighed heavily on the populace. The regency, which had begun on a note of hope, seemed to echo the very tyranny it had sought to replace. But perhaps the most poignant symbol of this period was the growing rift between Isabella and her son, Edward III. The young king, coming of age, found himself overshadowed by Mortimer's overpowering presence. The bond between mother and son, once unbreakable, began to strain. Edward's subtle attempts to assert his authority were met with resistance from Mortimer, who seemed unwilling to relinquish his hold on power. The palace walls, if they could speak, would tell tales of whispered conspiracies, of late-night councils, and of a young king's growing discontent. The very heart of the English monarchy was in turmoil. With each passing day, the stage was being set for a confrontation, one that would determine the true ruler of England. In the grand tapestry of time, the regency of Isabella and Mortimer stands out not merely for its political manoeuvres, but as a poignant reminder of the transient nature of power. It speaks of the delicate balance between ambition and governance, between personal desires and the greater good, and as the pages of history turned, it was becoming increasingly evident that their rule, built on a foundation of rebellion, would face its own reckoning. Visualize a kingdom, its very core pulsating with tension. England, under the shadow of the regency, was a land teetering on the edge of another revolution. The drama unfolding was Shakespearean in its grandeur. A young king, Edward III, stifled by the two figures who should have been his staunchest supporters, his mother, Isabella, and the formidable Roger Mortimer. Edward was no longer the malleable child of yesteryears. The boy had matured into a young man with a burgeoning sense of kingship. The whispers in the corridors spoke of his mounting frustration. It was said he felt like a puppet, with Mortimer's hand forever lurking, pulling the strings. A particular incident would forever mark the growing chasm between the young monarch and his regents. At a ceremony in Nottingham Castle, in the presence of the full court, Mortimer audaciously took a seat higher than the king himself, a symbolic gesture that did not go unnoticed. It was an affront, a silent declaration that the true power lay not with the crown, but with the man who'd so deftly manoeuvred his way into its shadow. Such transgressions, while subtle, began to galvanize a sense of purpose in Edward. He sought counsel from trusted allies, particularly the seasoned Earl of Lancaster, and began to weave a web of rebellion within the very heart of the kingdom. In the shadows and the silences, strategies were forged, loyalties tested, and a new revolution kindled. The climax to this simmering tension arrived on a fateful night in October 1330. Nottingham Castle, a bastion of stone and history, would bear witness to a coup. It would change the course of English history. With a handful of loyal supporters, Edward made his move. Using a secret passage, they infiltrated the castle, capturing Mortimer in a swift and decisive strike. The mighty regent, the puppeteer of English politics, found himself suddenly powerless, the tables turned in a poetic twist of fate. Isabella's plea, as heart-wrenching as it was, "Fair son, have pity on gentle Mortimer," echoed in the stone halls. But Edward's resolve was unwavering. For him, this was not just a political move. It was a reclaiming of his birthright, a statement to the realm and the world that he was king in more than just name. Mortimer's fate was sealed. Convicted of treason, he met his end on the gallows. And while Isabella's complicity in the regency's excesses was evident, Edward could not bring himself to exact revenge on his own mother. She was, instead, placed under house arrest, her role in governance effectively neutralized. The she-wolf of France, once the most powerful woman in England, was reduced to a quiet, albeit comfortable, exile. Edward's revolt was more than just a political coup. It was a clarion call of a new era. The young king, having cast aside the shackles of the regency, now stood poised to usher in a period of rejuvenation and renaissance for England. His reign would be marked by military successes, governance reforms, and an emphasis on chivalry and the arts. Yet the revolt also served as a poignant reminder of the cyclical nature of power. Just as Edward had risen against the might of the regency, history would bear witness to countless such uprisings, where the old was replaced by the new, only for the cycle to repeat in an eternal dance of ambition, legacy, and fate. In the vast tapestry of history, where each thread represents an individual's life, the golden strand of Isabella of France shines luminously, entwined with both brilliant victories and dark defeats. After the tempestuous storm of politics, war, and betrayal, there often follows a quiet, introspective calm. And so it was with Isabella in the twilight of her life. Imagine the grandeur of the English court, its stone halls echoing with whispers of past intrigues, slowly fading as the new reign of Edward III ushers in a fresh era. In a secluded manor in Castle Rising in Norfolk, away from the hustle and bustle of the crown's politics, Isabella finds her sanctuary. But this is not the tale of a defeated queen banished into obscurity. Rather, it is a story of resilience, reflection, and redemption. The she-wolf of France had once roamed the corridors of power with an indomitable spirit. Now, in the serene embrace of her estate, she lived a life markedly different from the political maelstrom of her prime. It was a life of contemplation, where the rhythmic cadence of prayer replaced the strategic machinations of the court. Yet, even in her solitude, Isabella's influence did not wane entirely. She remained a doting grandmother, passing on tales of her adventures and perhaps even her wisdom to the future monarchs of England. Her estate became a refuge for the arts and culture, where scholars and theologians found patronage. The woman who had once changed the course of nations now sought solace in the pages of manuscripts and the hymns of the church. And, despite the tumult of her past, the bond between Isabella and her son Edward showed signs of healing. Their relationship, previously strained by political intrigue, now bore the tender touches of a mother and son finding common ground. Edward would often visit, and their conversations, filled with memories, regrets, and hopes, painted a picture of two formidable personalities seeking understanding and closure. However, like the waning glow of an evening sun, shadows from Isabella's past occasionally darkened her present. Whispers of her involvement in the mysterious death of Edward II continued to circulate, and while her role in his alleged demise remained shrouded in mystery, the spectre of that fateful event continued to haunt her legacy. Yet, in the sanctuary of Castle Rising, Isabella sought to find peace with her past. She commissioned religious works, perhaps in an attempt to reconcile with her faith and find absolution. She became a benefactor to monasteries and churches, her contributions serving as testaments to her piety and her quest for redemption. In 1358, as winter's chill touched the English countryside, Isabella of France breathed her last. The she-wolf, who had once been the epicenter of seismic shifts in the English monarchy, departed in a quiet, dignified serenity. Her resting place in the Greyfriars Church in London became a symbol of her journey, a fusion of royal grandeur and monastic simplicity. In the annals of history, Isabella's later years serve as a reminder of the cyclical nature of life. Power, ambition, love, and betrayal had all played their roles in her life's grand theatre. But in the end, it was introspection, redemption, and a return to faith that defined her final act. A queen, a mother, a lover, and a sinner, Isabella's story is that of a woman who, despite the vagaries of fate, sought to find her own path, her own truth, in the intricate maze of destiny. The chronicles of time are punctuated with tales of kings and queens, warriors and visionaries, saints and sinners. Yet, among the myriad of stories, few capture the imagination as vividly as that of Isabella of France. The she-wolf, with her piercing gaze and iron resolve, left behind a legacy that extended far beyond her own era, echoing through the ages, a testament to her indomitable spirit. As dusk settles over the English landscape and the silhouettes of castles and cathedrals merge with the evening shadows, the narrative of Isabella's life looms large, its tales whispered through the corridors of time. What, then, remains the she-wolf's legacy? First, her influence on the English monarchy cannot be overstated. Through her decisive actions, the course of the monarchy was irrevocably changed. The removal of Edward II and the establishment of a regency paved the way for a more robust and stable reign under Edward III. The seeds of the Plantagenet dynasty's future successes were, in many ways, sown by Isabella's audacity. Moreover, her life served as a stark embodiment of the medieval woman's paradox. On one hand, she was a pawn in the dynastic politics of Europe, married off to serve the interests of nations. Yet, on the other, she emerged as a masterful player on the political stage, bending the arc of history with her will. Her journey, from a young French princess to the formidable she-wolf of England, serves as a testament to the indomitable spirit of women in an era dominated by men. Beyond the realm of politics, Isabella's patronage of the arts and the church left a lasting mark. Her love for literature, theology, and culture ensured that England remained a vibrant center of intellectual and artistic pursuits. The scholars she supported, the manuscripts she commissioned, and the monastic institutions she patronized all bear witness to a queen who understood the power of knowledge and faith. However, a legacy, much like a coin, has two sides. The mystery surrounding Edward IE's fate, the allegations of her role in his death and her tumultuous alliance with Mortimer also cast a shadow over her contribution. The she-wolf title, though later embraced as a mark of her strength, initially bore connotations of treachery and ruthlessness. Thus, the duality of her nature, both as a protector and a predator, adds layers of complexity to her narrative. As we draw the curtain on this riveting tale, let's reflect on the enduring allure of history. For in the stories of yesteryears, we find mirrors to our own lives, our own struggles, and our own aspirations. Isabella of France, the she-wolf, stands not just as a queen or a regent, but as a symbol of the human spirit's undying flame. Through love and war, through victory and defeat, her story reminds us of the strength within us all. In the heart of every castle enthusiast and historical mystery lover, there exists a deep reverence for tales that transcend time, tales that are etched in stone and whispered by the winds. And in this vast, intricate tapestry of history, Isabella's strand will forever shimmer, a testament to a life lived with passion, conviction, and an unyielding desire to shape her own destiny. As the pages of this chapter close, we're left with a sense of awe, a touch of mystery, and a profound respect for the she-wolf who once roamed the corridors of power, forever changing the landscape of the English monarchy. Thank you for joining us on this enchanting journey through medieval history. While our weekly episodes will continue to captivate your imagination, there's an exclusive treasure trove for subscribers, a secret vault of bonus episodes filled with extra tales and deep dives into the subjects we cover. Your curiosity fuels our mission, and we're truly thankful for your support. Until we meet again among stone walls and towering turrets, keep that torch of curiosity burning bright. Thank you for listening.